Room gets pretty warm. Today is Tuesday, September 20th, the year 2000. We're here in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Clarence Leland Winder for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial. The institution will be commemorating this event in the year 2000. As you can see, Professor Winder, we're taping this oral history. Do you give us permission to record?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with your educational and personal background a little bit. Where were you born and where did you go to school?
I was born on June 16, 1921 in a farmhouse in Kansas. And at the age of five, my family took me off to Southern California. So I started school in Pasadena, California, and eventually graduated from high school in Santa Barbara, and then after that I did my undergraduate work at UCLA. Took a little time out to participate in World War II and came back on the GI Bill to Stanford, where I did my master's and PhD in psychology. I got my PhD in 1949.
Mm-hmm. Where did you serve in the military?
Well, I was in what in those days was called the United States Army Air Force. I was a pilot. I did a combat tour in the Mediterranean theater.
Mm-hmm. Were you a bomber or a fighter pilot?
Pilot of a bomber.
Mm-hmm.
B-25, Billy B-25. Mitchell bomber.
I don't know if Fred Williams had flown those things.
I think he flew B-24s.
B-24s.
Mm-hmm. Fred and I occasionally relive a little bit of World War II.
He was my mentor here as an undergraduate.
Fine academic.
Mm-hmm. The what interested you in psychology as a field of study?
Well, probably two things generally. One, psychology seemed to me to be a discipline that had, as it was defined in those days, a broad scope. It was everything from what in these days would be called genetics to social psychology bordering on sociology. A term that's fairly frequently used now is biopsychosocial as the scope of the discipline. So it was an opportunity to learn a lot of things that seemed important and interesting. The other was that I became interested in the reading clinic that was operated by the psychology department at UCLA in those days. And I found that kind of work, that is, work with individuals who had goals but problems in achieving those goals, both instructive and challenging. So it was broad scope of intellectual interests plus an exposure to application of principles. So.
When you started as an undergraduate, did you intend on majoring in psychology, or was there someone that had an influence on you?
No, when I went to college, I was a chemistry major, first of all. And after that, I tried math for a while. And as I took courses in different areas, as I say, my attraction primarily was the intellectual scope of the discipline of psychology. So. Mm-hmm.
What was it like attending university under the GI Bill? What was the milieu like at that time?
Well, I was in graduate school by that time. We had an entering class the year that I started in 1945 at Stanford of probably about two dozen returning vets. And it was it's a combination of a lot of camaraderie, but a lot of intense competition. So it was a good show.
How was it that you ultimately came to Michigan State?
Well, in about 1959, I think it probably was, Stanford engaged in a rather intensive self-study aimed at defining its mission for the next 15, 20 years as a higher education institution. And the decision, the institutional decision, was to emphasize what was termed in those days as theory and basic research. So that it was a place that was not going to commit a lot of its resources or interest to applied areas, with a couple of notable exceptions. Engineering, business, and law were sort of protected from the mandate to become committed in basic theory and research. So I reviewed my interests. I could have stayed at Stanford. I was just tenured, and I could have stayed. But I really believed that if I were going to be honest with the institution, that I'd have to shift out of clinical psychology into either child development or personality psychology. And at that point in my career, I was very much committed to graduate education in clinical psychology. So I wasn't really looking for a move, but when Michigan State came knocking on the door and said they were looking for someone to try to refocus and energize their graduate program, clinical psychology, I decided it sounded like a good move for me, and I moved.
Who made that contact with you, that first?
A fellow named Lou McQuitty.
Okay, all right.
Lou McQuitty was the, as they were known in those days, the head of the Department of Psychology here. He and I met at a American Psychological Association conference on graduate education in psychology along about the 1960, 59, 60 time frame. So he and I shared some interests in trying to keep a very close, interactive stance between theoretical psychology and applied psychology. His area in those days was called industrial psychology. These days it would probably be called organizational psychology. And while we were in different applied areas, there was some overlap in the areas. For example, psychological assessment was important in both industrial and in clinical, but the main thing that we shared was this sort of axiomatic belief that if psychology was going to be as strong a contributor to the general welfare as we thought it could be, that there had to be the preservation, as I say, of this interface and interaction between what one might call principles and theory of psychology and basic research related to those issues and applied psychology.
So, so you came in the early 1960s?
I came 1961.
1961, okay. What were your impressions of the campus when you first arrived? Quite a contrast from the West Coast.
although it certainly was a beautiful campus. I visited in the summer of 1961, and it was obvious that it was very attractive. But the thing that really impressed me about the institution was the combination of John Hanna and a whole cadre of very vigorous, strongly intellectually committed faculty. For example, in the College of Social Science, where the Department of Social Psychology came to be administered, in 1961 it was still part of the General Arts and Sciences College. We had people like John Eusine and others in sociology, and we had some excellent people in political science. There was a very fine department of probability and statistics, so there were just a lot of intellectual attractions mm-hmm. to the place. And
was there a lot of collaboration across the disciplinary or boundary lines at that time?
That was one of John Hanna's themes, that he believed, as he told me, that higher education needed to struggle with the problem of keeping the boundaries between disciplines and among professions as permeable as possible, because from his perspective, a lot of the things that were accepted as organizational givens in higher education could become impediments to programs, to progress, to advancements mm-hmm. of a variety of kinds. And so, of course, he was very much committed to the idea that you needed strong research and strong applications working together, you know, the mm-hmm. tradition of agriculture, the basic research in animal sciences, plant sciences, biology, zoology, all those things interacting with applications through the Ag Experiment Stations and the Cooperative Extension Service. It was a very congenial general concept as far as I was concerned. And the other thing about John Hanna was that it was clear that he was ambitious that Michigan State would become a genuine research-oriented institution.
Did you have much personal contact with him, either as in psychology or?
No, well, but I had a very pleasant, informative, long interview with him when I was here, they were looking at me and I was looking at the university. After that, I had very little contact with him until I became dean of the College of Social Science. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I was in the Council of Deans and he met regularly with the Council of Deans. Mm-hmm.
So. Okay. The Council of Social Science, when you assumed the deanship, was there a reorganization prior to that? Or?
Yes. And I'm not exactly sure of the date. I think it was at the end of the 1961-62 academic year, there was a major reorganization, and the previously existing General College of Arts and Sciences was divided into three parts and became the three colleges: Arts and Letters, Natural Science, and Social Science.
Social Science. Okay. Did you have an interest in becoming an administrator when you became dean, or you were here?
I find that a very amusing topic in mm-hmm. retrospect. You know, I left Stanford mm-hmm. because I didn't see much future there for the graduate program in clinical psychology. So I came here as the director of the psychological clinic and excuse me, the program director for the doctoral program in clinical psychology. Actually, I was here 1 year, and I went off to USC for a year, and then I came back to be department chairperson.
I see.
And from there on, it was the slippery slope. Chairperson, dean, associate provost, and provost.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of those, some of that slippery slope that, that your career was involved in. What do you remember when you were dean of College of Social Science? What were some of the, you were here, let's see, and you became dean in 1967?
Correct.
I think, is that right?
Yes.
What were some of the issues, key issues? Obviously, the 60s were a turbulent time generally on campuses, but Michigan State it was in particular. Did any of those affect the School of Social Science?
Oh, sure. But the main focus, excuse me, of the faculty and I would say most of the student body was on the improving academic quality of the institution. Now we became, as you note, one of the sites where there was a lot of expression of so-called student activism. Mm-hmm. But we managed to run institutional development, as I call it, mm-hmm. parallel to student activism. So we had to deal with the issues of student activism, obviously, but we managed, I think, pretty well not to let that really get us off message, as they say in the presidential campaign these days. Mm-hmm. The message was Michigan State University is going to join the elite circle of research-oriented universities. Mm-hmm. And we worked at that pretty consistently.
When was that accomplished? Do you remember?
Well, has it been accomplished?
Oh, has it been?
that's the question.
Yeah,
that comes
that's right.
By.
More theoretical.
One of the really tremendous achievements along that path was election of Michigan State University to membership in the Association of American Universities mm-hmm. in 1963. And it was about the same time that we were chartered to have a chapter of Phi Beta Kappa. Now, my view of higher education institutional development is that it's a multi-generation project. Mm-hmm. And I think we're still about the business of making sure that we take opportunities and expend the effort and resources when we can make improvements in academic quality. And I think that's been a guiding principle ever since I arrived on this campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It's gone through several administrations and mm-hmm. a number of crises, but that's been a pretty consistent commitment.
Mm-hmm. How was it that you became provost? Let's start first with associate provost. You worked first with John Cantlin, was it?
While I was dean of the College of Social Science, of course, John Cantlin was provost. We found that we had a lot of shared both goals and ideas about process as to how to advance academic enterprise. And there came a point in time when Herman King, who had the title of assistant provost, there were several assistant provosts, his responsibility, Herman King's responsibility was focused on the academic budget. And Herman King decided that he really did not want to continue to have that responsibility. So John Catlin approached me and asked if I would be willing to take over that job. And I thought about that long and hard, and my response to John was that I wouldn't take over the job as an assistant provost. But if he and the president, Wharton, wanted to establish position of associate provost, so it was clear that I was number two, would be number two in the provost office, that I would do that. And they did, and I did, and there it was, 1974.
Mm-hmm. So there was a reorganization at that time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What were your main duties at that time?
Well, my main duty really was to do program planning and program budgeting for the academic area. Of course, under John Catlin's oversight, but, I did a lot of the meeting with the deans and occasionally with deans and chairpersons, directors of an individual college, such as Arts and Letters or whatever, and worked through the development of some different procedures for departments, schools, centers, et cetera, to use in formulating their plans for the future, their programmatic proposals, and the associated resource stipulations that were needed. And that included, obviously, the annual budgets, but also space and various other things in the way of resources.
What was it like working in the Wharton administration?
I have to say it was I don't know which word to offer first, which descriptor to offer first. It was challenging and pleasant. Cliff Wharton is one of the most civil people I have ever known. But he's also one of the brightest and most intellectually demanding people I've ever known. So it was a good experience.
What were your main dealings with him? Did you deal with him on a weekly basis, or was it
not really? Again, the Council of Deans was an important vehicle for interaction between the deans as a group and the provost and the president. And most of the times when I had more or less a direct exchange with Cliff, it was in the setting of the Council of Deans. Now, in addition to that, John would involve me in meetings with Cliff when they were discussing possibilities for programmatic elaborations, changes in one or more of the colleges. So, I had some direct contact with Cliff, but it was mostly in the setting of one kind of meeting or another.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised when Now you became provost under Dr. Wharton, is that right?
Yeah, I tell Cliff, he recommended me to be provost, and the board made the appointment. Uh-huh. He realized what he'd done, so he went off to SUNY to be chancellor.
That was your take on why he left.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We knew he was leaving in good hands. So, and that was, he did leave right not
very
long
shortly.
After.
I've forgotten the exact date, but it was like October or maybe November.
Of 1977?
Sure. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had been appointed effective July 1.
Uh-huh.
As provost.
1977. Yes. So the first president that you dealt with, or interim, was Ed Hardin, is that right? Or
well, did you? First Cliff.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Ed Hardin came as interim. You know. Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised that the Horton's leaving?
I was amazed. Uh-huh.
You thought he was going
you
to
didn't
be here.
You didn't ask me for my advice on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, candidly, Cliff had a kind of albatross because he was elected president on a 5-3 vote of the board, and that really never changed significantly.
That ratio was with him?
Or it was always right there, mm-hmm. you know, ready to manifest itself. Mm-hmm. And so it was a tough duty.
Mm-hmm. What were your workings with Dr. Hardin?
Oh, Ed and I had lots of fun. I don't know whether you knew Ed Hardin or not.
I never met him, but...
He's sort of the prototypical extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I'm not... perhaps the prototypical introvert, but I'm certainly not all that extroverted. And so Ed and I had, we had lots of fun because we tended to have, I'll use the word parallel views of things. It wasn't that we were really at odds very much, but we tended to make different assumptions. We tended to bring different objectives to a situation. We tended to be interested in different parameters of what was going on. So mm-hmm. it was an interesting time. And Ed chose to involve me somewhat in interactions with members of the legislature, so that was a learning experience.
Did you have to testify or at the legislature?
When we went to meetings of the higher education subcommittees of the House and the Senate, I was present and mm-hmm. participated to some extent, but with Ed, hardly anybody on the university side besides Ed participated.
Mm-hmm. I see. And that was Nick Jacobetti's committee, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. He was on the House side.
Uh-huh.
Early on, there was a man named Zoller. Mm-hmm. Can't remember his first name at the moment, who was from the west side of Michigan, someplace such as Holland or Zeeland mm-hmm. or some such place over there. And that was an interesting contrast, too, between Jacobetti and Zoller. They really had very different world views. But Ed was careful how I phrase this exactly. One of the instruments that John Hanna used deliberately in the process of good institutional development of this institution, this university, was to continue to expand the enrollment. If you think of it in simplistic budgetary terms, if you added an additional 500 freshmen each year, mm-hmm. expanded the size of the freshman class, the tuition from those 500 enrollments was an add-on, and it was flexible money mm-hmm. because you could usually assimilate, because you were adding faculty in the total process, you could usually assimilate those additional enrollments without very much additional direct expenditure, so to speak. So mm-hmm. it was an interesting tactical program that Hanna and Phil May, the vice president for finance, had put into place. And I would say that Cliff Wharton saw important alternative ways to enhance academic quality was somewhat, in my perception, cautious about additional expansion of the size of the student body. Ed Hardin came in, and he was very much like John Hanna Jr. in the way he viewed things.
Mm-hmm. So bigger was better, or larger student body.
Well, bigger permitted you more flexibility. And, mm-hmm. But bigger is better is also part of it. I think that's fair.
Were there any notable issues that you recall that you had to deal with under his administration?
Well, the enrollment issue was a major issue. I remember quite well the day that I walked into